That was the famous haka performed by the All Blacks prior to their rugby match against France in June of 2013. The All Blacks have been known for performing the haka for decades. It's a tradition with its origins in Māori culture, and it has since become synonymous with the All Blacks. However, it has often been the source of controversy, with some believing it inappropriate and not in keeping with the spirit of fair play. The variation you just heard is known as kapa or pongo, and it was introduced in 2005 and has perhaps been the most controversially received of the All Blacks hakas. If you follow the link in the show notes to the YouTube version of that audio, you'll notice that in the closing stanza, the players mime a cutting motion across their chests or throats. Rather than being a sign of throat slitting, though, it represents the breathing of life into the heart and lungs. However, this may have been interpreted a little more liberally by many members of this famous team over the years. So what is the right answer? What purpose does the haka serve, and who should say whether it's a rousing tradition celebrated by fans of rugby the world over, a symbol of cultural significance that acknowledges the pride and history of New Zealand and its most famous sportsmen, or a jingoistic chant whose purpose is primarily for marketing? It's been a while since we've considered a topic from philosophy on an episode of the Here and Now podcast, but this one has been on my mind for a while. So how would we describe an argument for or against the haka? We could take a consequentialist view and simply ask the question, is any harm being inflicted by it, and if so, against who? If the answer is no one, then surely there is no reason to abandon it. But what is harm? It's not physical in this instance, not until the whistle blows at least, but perhaps it is emotional or psychological. It is not honourable to mime the act of killing one's opponent in civilised society. So therefore, it should be banned. But this is not a satisfying answer. As to one society, it's not only reasonable, it's celebrated, and while on the other hand, some members of the other society find it offensive. This is a trivial example in many ways, so let's make it a bit more meaningful and take a more challenging case of, say, euthanasia. The practice of intentionally terminating life to end suffering. Now the stakes are much higher. Lives and freedom are in the balance, and just as opinions on the haka will vary, so too will opinions on this difficult social issue. So how can we go about deciding what is right in these cases? Let's take Holland for example. Holland legalised euthanasia in 2001, but it had been under discussion for nearly 3 decades when it was finally accepted into Dutch law. Today, around 5 countries have legalised euthanasia, and some states of the US and one in Australia have also allowed the practice, subject to a range of criteria and conditions. But the tide is shifting. New Zealand has an upcoming referendum on the issue to coincide with its general election and a vote to legalise cannabis. They really know how to divide a country. And 20 or 30 other countries already have a variety of policies and different conversations ongoing regarding this key moral issue. So in the case of New Zealand, the government is simply putting it to the people. There's no attempt here to provide a framework or justification for choosing one camp or the other, although plenty of lobby groups are doing just that. Ultimately, the decision rests with each individual to determine how they feel about the issue, and the side with the most support will win. This isn't objective in any meaningful sense. It's entirely subjective, where the winner takes all. There is no basis for the decision other than what you think. Is that enough? Here we are in 2020, facing a significant decision in which life and death and the basic human right to freedom is literally on the line. And we aren't turning to our scientists, our philosophers, politicians, or priests for the answer. We're instead being asked to turn inward, to ask ourselves the question, and the answer for each of us will be influenced by our lived experiences. If we have witnessed the slow, painful decline of a loved one in the clutches of a cruel and debilitating illness, then perhaps we would favour a choice to die with dignity and on our terms. Or perhaps we have faith in a higher power and believe such an act would defile the sacred gift of life and the fate ordained for us by God alone. Clearly then, the decision is contingent upon our personal experience, of our upbringing, of our family, community, and all of these other factors which psychologists, geneticists, and anthropologists would call the environment. But these are not new challenges for us, although sometimes it might feel like our way of life and the beliefs we cherish are under threat by a world changing faster than we can keep up with. Really, though, humanity has been faced with tough decisions for millennia, and the hard questions of ancient Greece are just as hard today. There is nothing new under the sun, as they say. Take the Persian king Darius, for instance. As described by ancient Greek historian Herodotus, Darius asked a group of Greek noblemen at what price would they be willing to eat the corpses of their fathers after they'd passed away. Of course, they said no price would convince them to partake of such a macabre ritual. Yet that was just such a custom of the Kalesha tribe of India, members of whom also happened to be in attendance. So Darius turned to this group and asked them if they would burn the bodies of their fathers after they have passed, which is a ritual carried out by the Greeks of that day and indeed many of us now. The Kalesha were horrified at the suggestion of desecrating their closest loved ones. So clearly each society had unique norms and rituals which the other found abhorrent. So who was right? What is the right way to behave? As we've seen, these questions perplex us just as much today as they did in the 5th century and surely long before that as well. This quandary of right and wrong is a question of morality, and the answer, it depends, is a philosophical position known as moral relativism. Put simply, moral relativism is the idea that the authority of moral norms is relative to not just time, but also place. How you feel about the rightness or wrongness of something is entirely contingent upon not just the culture, norms, and values of where you are from, but also the time you are from. As such, there is no such thing as a moral absolute, a clear line in the sand that we can all agree delineates acceptable behaviour from the loathsome. History is replete with examples. Slavery is a commonly cited one. Today we look back on the past with shame. How could our distant relatives have condoned and propagated such an inhumane practice? But slavery was once widespread. To the people of that time, it was perfectly reasonable, perhaps even righteous, to lift the otherwise destitute from their squalid, barbarous conditions and bring them to the new world where they could learn and thrive at the hands of their educated, white masters. The pendulum of morality has since swung away from that perspective, but it has swung back and forth across the generations and across the world. Morality has indeed been relative, and for many, it continues to be so. But this definition is really just scratching the surface of this broad and complex topic. We can't tackle it all here, and we certainly aren't going to solve any of the dilemmas raised. Our purpose is to identify what we mean by moral relativism, and to encourage you to perhaps broaden your own perspective about what is right and wrong, and to question why you feel that way. As we'll see, it's very difficult to determine an absolute. There is always a contradiction, a counter-argument, a damned thought experiment, or some other seemingly plausible reason which challenges our beliefs, assumptions, and ontologies. But firstly, let's outline what we mean by moral relativism. As philosophers can never seem to agree on a definition, it is always contingent. It means different things to different people, depending on how we frame it. So I'll borrow from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, edited by James Fieser and Bradley Dowden, and contributed to by many philosophers from around the world. So there's the first type of moral relativism is known as descriptive relativism. This is simply to say that there are indeed moral differences between how different groups of people act according to their beliefs, without casting judgment on the rightness or wrongness of those beliefs. This is primarily an anthropological argument, based on observations of differing cultures around the world who appear to operate according to differing sets of norms and value systems. It might come as no surprise to learn that the most extreme version of descriptive relativism holds that there are no universal morals which govern the bounds of human behaviour. Most of us would tend to agree, though, that there are some things we hold sacred. That is, to protect children from harm, to not kill each other, to not have incestuous relationships, and so on. Although there are many cases of exactly those acts taking place. So even though we might agree that there are some fundamental moral norms we should all adhere to, we can't quite agree on what they are. So just the fact that those differences exist make relativism descriptive. Those that argue against this form of relativism say that even within societies and cultures, values are constantly shifting. Homosexuality, for instance, may be considered a sin in a highly religious culture, but as beliefs shift, society becomes more liberal and accepting of difference, and so morals tend to change along with it. It is not enough to say that there are differences between groups, though. There must be something more to moral relativism. Relativism could also, therefore, be thought of as cultural and specific to a time and place, again described without judgment, but considered in context. 16th century French philosopher Michel de Montaigne, when thinking about the cannibalistic norms of a South American tribe, wrote, quote, "There is nothing savage or barbarous about those peoples, but that every man calls barbarous anything he is not accustomed to. It is indeed the case that we have no other criterion of truth or right reason than the example and form of the opinions and customs of our own country." To see the world in any other way, that is, to hold the belief that one's own morals are a cultural ideal to which we should all subscribe, is known as ethnocentrism, and that is a dangerous position to support. However, to believe that there are no universal morals of any kind is an argument which doesn't sit well with many people. So morality is also considered to be meta-ethical, like cultural relativism. It varies according to local norms and therefore can be judged against those norms. The implications of meta-ethical moral relativism. Firstly, it requires us to be tolerant of other cultures. But is that really something that we want? Should we consider tolerance as more important than universal morality for all of humanity? What if one culture's practices, however moral they may be to that culture, cause immeasurable harm to others, be it animal or human? Should we intervene and set a global standard? Perhaps before we can even begin to answer such questions, we need to go back a bit further to understand where morality comes from. It begins in childhood, literally. Morality, as with many ideas long grounded in religion, is not something we are born with. It develops within us as our brains grow, learn, and mature. Swiss developmental psychologist Jean Piaget was one of the first to study this closely by testing the cognitive development of children through tests to decipher how they saw the world. For instance, in one experiment, he'd pour water into identical glasses and ask a child if they thought the glasses contained the same amount of water. Then he'd pour the water from one glass into a tall, skinny glass. Now the level of water in the tall glass was much higher than in the previous glass as he placed it down next to the second shorter glass. Did they still contain the same amount of water, he'd asked the children. And children under, say, 7 would invariably reply that the tall glass held more water. But no matter how we tried to explain the concept that the volume of water was conserved, they couldn't grasp it. Not yet. But eventually, as their brains developed, they would. Knowledge and understanding of the world comes with cognitive development. Piaget also noticed that this rule also applied to how children perceive rules and resolve conflicts and manage their thoughts and feelings around what is considered to be right and wrong. Piaget's research was then expanded upon by Lawrence Kohlberg, who quantified the level of moral development in children through a range of tests. From his research, Kohlberg identified a 6-stage progression through social reasoning, categorized according to 3 key levels. The first was pre-conventional, then the conventional, and finally post-conventional. Aside from the obvious, what really separated older children in the post-conventional stage, who were, say, teenagers and young adults, from younger ones in the conventional stage, was their ability to put themselves in the shoes of others and see morality from their perspective, a sort of relativity that gave context and rationale to the choices made by others. Just as Piaget couldn't explain why the water in the glasses was the same to young children whose minds were not yet developed enough to understand the optical illusion, children cannot authentically experience a detached perspective until their brains have developed enough to allow them to step beyond themselves. Morality, in this way, is learned through practice and observation. Part of that practice is the experience of harm to themselves through painful slips and falls, and the cruel and hurtful behaviour of their peers who leave them out, tease them, and take their things. They learn how it must feel because they have felt it themselves. They form a rationale for acting morally toward others. But we don't have to go around raping and murdering to learn that it is wrong, so at some point it is enough to know that some things are just wrong. We understand harm well enough to make such qualified assumptions. This notion of learned or assumed harm is propagated through stories, novels, music, movies, and the news. We don't have to experience or witness these acts directly because they are shown to us in every conceivable construction, as though we are testing our moral intuitions by continually reminding ourselves of why we should think harmful acts are indeed bad and immoral. But this is only part of the story. The other part is that morality is an evolutionary development to aid our survival. For learning how to cooperate and survive together has been the key to the success of Homo sapiens. Morality did not spring forth from the tree of knowledge. It evolved to contain our impulses. But we must learn it slowly through exposure. And sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes we miss it altogether. Fundamentally, morality resides within our conscience. It is intuitive. Here's a question I've lifted from Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. Say a man buys a chicken from the supermarket, takes it home, then has sexual intercourse with it. He then cooks the chicken and eats it. Is that morally wrong? It's disgusting, sure, but is it wrong? The chicken was already dead, so it didn't come to harm from his acts, and the chicken was still a source of food. The act was carried out in private, so while it might be unpalatable to most of us, it isn't necessarily morally wrong. It turns out that how this act is rationalised varies depending on not just culture, but where in that culture an individual is situated. For those from developed countries with high education and wealth, they consider it an individual right, as disgusting as it is. To them, it is not morally wrong. However, when working class people from the same cultures are asked the same question, to them, it is unquestionably and emphatically immoral. In fact, much of the world sees morality in this way, and the educated, wealthy class from developed countries are the outliers. It's as though they've had to reprogram their intuitions. Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman describes two internal psychological systems that inform our behaviour. System 1 happens quickly. It doesn't take the time to rationalise. It observes and acts. It's informed by the autonomic nervous system, like how we respond to immediate threats of danger. System 2 is much slower. It's rational, analytic, and it takes the time to consider the options before settling on an informed decision. Morality prefers to act through System 1. We are instinctively primed to view certain behaviours as immoral. But when we employ System 2 to really weigh an issue up by considering its potential for harm and whether it outweighs the right to freedom, then a different answer emerges. Haidt thinks of System 1, our intuition, as an elephant, while our rational System 2 minds are the rider perched atop the elephant. The rider may think they are leading the elephant, but really the elephant is intelligent and moving of its own accord. The rider is exactly that, just going along for the ride, trying to coax the conscience along on its own path of reason, but it is fighting a losing battle. So the argument here is about just how much rationality goes into our moral convictions, and of course, whether morality is relative if we all see the world in slightly different ways. It's tempting to view the world as one way, regardless of language, culture, and religion, because it seems that we could all agree on certain moral foundations that stand beneath every other layer of behaviour which we could stack upon it. But neuroscience and psychology offer another perspective. There was the famous case of Phineas Gage, a railway worker from the 19th century who had a steel tamping rod blasted straight through his brain. Gage survived for another 12 years after the accident, with a substantial chunk of his frontal lobe missing, but his personality fluctuated during this time as a result of the traumatic injury. The extent to which this actually occurred is not fully known, as Gage's story has been dramatised, exaggerated, and embellished over the years. But it does serve as an example of the fragility of the human temperament and the notion of an intuitive morality. Morality is not necessarily something that emerges spontaneously with the advent of evolved consciousness like our own, residing in our souls and guided by the cosmic will of a creator or the deeper meaning of the universe. Is it? Another example comes from a 1972 study of helping behaviour conducted by Ellis Island and Paula Levin. They conducted two experiments. In the first, a row of people studying in a university library were approached and offered a cookie. After a while, the same students were asked if they would be willing to participate in a psychology study. The researchers also approached a group of students studying at adjacent tables, but who had not been given the cookie, and asked them the same question, if they'd like to participate. In the second experiment, the researchers left coins in the return slot of a payphone, but not for all users. So they'd wait for people to go to the payphone, they'd leave a coin at random in some of them, and for all the people that used the phone, as they walked away, the researcher or an experimenter would walk in front of the person after they left the phone and drop a folder of papers on the floor. And they wanted to see how many people helped the person to pick up the papers. So the results of both experiments were pretty conclusive. In each case, whether the people were primed with a cookie or whether they found the coin in the change slot of the telephone, they were more likely to either participate in the study or to help the person pick up the papers. So the results were that basically when primed to feel good by either the cookie or the coin, the subjects were far more likely to help others. So this suggests that our moral tendencies are far more fickle than we might otherwise imagine. They're subject to influence and persuasion, so subtle that we are often not even aware of it. Okay, I hear you saying, that's fine when it comes to something trivial, but we are hardly going to change our minds about harm-causing behaviour when it comes to how we feel. You'd have to be in a pretty damn good mood to condone cannibalism. But the point is not that there are never cases where this is not applicable. There are. But much of what we would consider to be ethical or moral judgments are influenced by something as subtle as our mood, particularly when there is no identifiable victim of harm. This is a position known as situationism, and it says that morality is contingent upon circumstance. Let's return to Maslow's hierarchy of needs for this example. Imagine you're in a prison camp. You're starving. You're tick-ridden. You're hanging on for life as many of your fellow prisoners die from torture, illness, and starvation around you every day. But what if you're offered a reprieve, better rations, more freedom and power over your fellow prisoners? Now, it might require you to beat and harass them, but it'll keep you alive. So you take the role and act as a guard of your own people, but your position is contested. Others too want the extra rations and relief from forced labour. So you must act more viciously to protect your position and to remain in power. Now, all that matters is getting enough food and water, and if that means adapting morally, then so be it. This is precisely what Auschwitz survivor Primo Levi writes of in his autobiography, If This Is a Man. Prisoners who had been made overseers of the prison labourers would beat their workers under the watchful eye of their Nazi captors. Levi writes, many would beat their subjects almost lovingly, accompanying the blows with exultations as cart drivers do with willing horses. They knew that the external pain would help to distract the labourers from their own fatigue and help push them through the day's work. This suggests that even physical harm can go from being a morally detestable action to a benevolent one, further complicating the notion of morality as a fixed construct. Often though, even when we think about it and can see both sides of the argument, we find a situation so objectionable that it is just plain wrong, even if no harm comes of it. Here's another example provided by Jonathan Haidt. I'll just read it verbatim straight from the study. It's going to turn your stomach, I apologise in advance. Julie and Mark, who are sister and brother, are travelling together in France. They are both on summer vacation from college. One night they are staying alone in a cabin near the beach. They decided it would be interesting and fun if they tried making love. At the very least, it would be a new experience for each of them. Julie is already taking birth control pills, but Mark uses a condom too, just to be safe. They both enjoy it, but they decide not to do it again. They keep that night as a special secret between them, which makes them feel even closer to each other. So what do you think about this? was it wrong for them to have sex? When asked, most people would say that this is morally wrong. It's incest after all, even if no harm comes from it. This is a System 1 response. It feels wrong. But when asked to provide reasons why it is wrong, people often struggle. Haid describes this inability to specifically express why an act is, such as this is morally wrong, even when no harm befalls anyone, as being morally dumbfounded. This is the rider trying to steer the elephant in Haid's analogy. It's instinctual even though we can't explain why. We've struck upon a social taboo, but is this really a question of morality? It seems that it's the notion of social that makes morality meaningful. It's not just about acceptable harms, as in eating meat, or no harms at all, as in this example. It's about how we feel about how others would feel about it. Morality is relative not only between cultures or societies, but within societies who fear the condescending glare of others. So how far have we come in this episode? I feel like not very far, such is the challenge of philosophy and a topic as prickly as moral relativism. But the good news is someone, in fact a lot of people, have already made many of the decisions about what is morally right for us. On December 10th, 1948, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights came into force. It outlined in 30 articles the basic rights and freedoms that should be enjoyed by all people. I'm going to read the first five articles of the Declaration. Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, colour, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-governing or under any other limitation of sovereignty. Article 3. Everyone has the right to life, liberty and security of person. Article 4. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. Article 5. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. I read them all here, or at least these first five, because I think they serve as an important reminder of what a great majority of humans on this planet have come to agree upon as objective morals that stand outside of relative judgment. What do you think about them? They don't talk about many of the issues that we've described so far. Keep in mind that these emerged in the wake of the Second World War, where humankind had witnessed some of the cruelest atrocities in history. The industrialized killing of millions, the attempt to annihilate entire sects of society. Unfortunately, the Human Rights Declaration has done little to stop morally relativistic murder in the intervening decades. Various political, religious, and ideological movements have sought to inflict their particular brand of morality, often with terrible outcomes for many millions more. And so, to return to moral relativism as a philosophical concept, the mere notion that different people, groups and cultures see the world through a different lens to us is a justifiable position, but it is not a sound argument to say that being relativist rather than absolutist with our morals condemns us to evil. Because history has demonstrated that the most heinous acts have not been carried out by those accepting of difference, but by those who wish to eradicate it. The moral relativists, then, are perhaps the most accommodating of human diversity. And when the question of harm is introduced, then the view becomes consequentialist. Whichever way results in the greatest good and the least harm must be the right way. But the problem is, that's a System 2 decision. We can rationalize our way to condoning incest or euthanasia, but it doesn't make those choices feel any better for most of us. It's only through our intuitions that we can make judgments. But those intuitions are subject to all of the normative influences reined upon us from the earliest moments of our lives. So how can morality be anything but relative when to be human is in and of itself to be uniquely individual, cultural, shaped, moulded and constructed by society? So I ask you, when considering difficult moral questions, hold tightly to your beliefs if you must, but remember some, if not all of them, are relative. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Here and Now podcast or Twitter at Here Now podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to keep up to date with all of the latest episodes. And if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon or leave a review at the Apple Podcasts app. You can reach out to me via the pages or email thehereandnow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.